The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Our second reading this morning is from Jonathan Egg's King a Life. It's toward the end of the book in the last chapter. He shares this vignette in Words of Kings. On February 4th at Ebenezer, King preached to the congregation about the virtues of service and the shallow meaning of personal greatness. He began slowly, stating the title of his sermon and reading from the Bible, and gradually gained speed and strength. When a baby cried, he worked it into his sermon. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention, he said. Even infants innately possess the drum major instinct. Adults have it too. We like to do something good, and you know, we like to be praised for it, he said. He talked about people who spend large sums of money to impress their neighbors and others who brag about their college degrees. The hunger for attention can be dangerous, he said. It drives people to lie, it compels people to insist on the superiority of one race to another. It makes corporations greedy. It propels nations to war. As King preached, his father shouted out repeatedly, "Make it plain! Make it plain!" King made it plain. "There's nothing wrong with the pursuit of greatness," he said. "If you seek greatness in serving others, everyone can be great because everyone can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and verb agree to serve. You only need a heart full of grace and a soul generated by love. And you can be that servant." Here ends our reading. That was one of King's favorite hymns. There are stories of Mahalia Jackson calling him in difficult moments late at night and him asking for her just to sing that hymn to him. Our second reading this morning is from Jonathan Egg's King a Life. It's toward the end of the book in the last chapter. He shares this vignette in Words of Kings. On February 4th at Ebenezer, King preached to the congregation about the virtues of service and the shallow meaning of personal greatness. He began slowly, stating the title of his sermon and reading from the Bible, and gradually gained speed and strength. When a baby cried, he worked it into his sermon. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention, he said. Even infants innately possess the drum major instinct. Adults have it too. We like to do something good, and you know, we like to be praised for it, he said. He talked about people who spend large sums of money to impress their neighbors and others who brag about their college degrees. The hunger for attention can be dangerous, he said. It drives people to lie, compels people to insist on the superiority of one race to another. It makes corporations greedy. It propels nations to war. As King preached, his father shouted out repeatedly, "Make it plain! Make it plain!" King made it plain. "There's nothing wrong with the pursuit of greatness," he said. "If you seek greatness in serving others, everyone can be great because everyone can serve. You don't have to have a college degree to serve. You don't have to make your subject and verb agree to serve. You only need a heart full of grace and a soul generated by love. And you can be that servant." Here ends our reading. The piece you're about to hear is entitled MLK by U2. This summer I read Jonathan Egg's new biography of King, King a Life. Egg, a journalist who's written biographies of Jackie Robinson and Lou Gehrig, a history of the fight for the birth control pill, a look at Al Capone, and a series of children's books. He says that part of what is compelling about this new book, arguably one in a sea of biographies of King, are the resources that he had available to him heretofore unavailable. Resources that included government records that have now been unsealed, vast FBI documents included, but also people who heretofore didn't want to be interviewed about the man they knew, the gorgeous and the complicated bits, but with time were willing to share their stories. The book won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography in 2024. Ken Burns calls Egg a master storyteller, which is good because the biography is 700 pages long. It was a good and important book to read in a summer when I was desperate for a hero to show up in our world. A particular hero, one with a vision and the integrity of commitment to a cause larger than themselves, for that commitment to be large-souled and large-hearted and about agape, that self-transcending love and service. It was good to be re-immersed in the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr. There was a lot I already knew about King's life and the civil rights movement from other books, including King's own memoirs. I didn't schedule this sermon because I thought it would be relevant to the inauguration, just that it felt like the right text for the day, given this particular weekend. But it is a good text for this particular weekend, all of it. Each era, it turns out, has its own challenges and opportunities. And each era, if it's wise, the people in it, they're fed by the stories and learnings of those who navigated the challenges and possibilities of their own times. And three things stuck with me after reading the book that felt good to keep in mind as we step into our own wrestling and calls to service. What first struck me, and so many reviews mention, was the depth of the FBI tracking and interference with the work of King, the lengths to which Herbert Hoover, drunk with power and enmity toward King, drove the efforts, abused his position, and all the others who participated in that abuse, which is all made so much more clear than we even knew before by the increased unsealed documents, the volumes of them. The illegal and legal tracking of the comings and goings of King and his colleagues, the tapping of phones and hotel rooms, and even trying to prompt King to take his own life by sending a recording of a tape of him in a hotel room engaged in indiscretions and threatening to release it to the press, a package Coretta accidentally intercepts. So much that's an example of a government undermining its own citizens and those citizens in their attempts to marshal change in the nation. It felt like a very timely reminder of how citizens have to be on our guard, government only as moral as those who patrol it. Power corrupts, Henry Kissinger famously said, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it's a reminder to keep the checks and balances as strongly in place as we can, and the watchdog groups funded and protected, and a reminder of just what kinds of risks happen when the guardrails come off and transparency ceases to be the coin of the realm. one of the thin silver linings of all of the FBI documents and gathering and tracking, however, was that there was a lot more information about King's life and work, recordings of conversations. Between that and all of those more robust interviews with the inner circle of King's life and ministry, you really do get this rich, deeper sense of the civil rights movement and what it looked like pulling back the curtain on the public-facing moments that we all know so well. We see two things behind the curtain, two other themes that struck me and stuck with me. One was King's heroic humanity. Heroic humanity. One of King's friends and colleagues said, "We used to say he not only had a war on poverty, he had a war on sleep." In the book, you hear how King would want to step away and take a sabbatical in the incredibly long road through all these different pieces of the work that he's doing, but how he couldn't ever take the step to do it because the work was so important. And I felt so much empathy for this person who saw how clearly how high the stakes were, who knew people needed him to be the rock they could lean on, who felt so deeply the beauty and the courage of the average Black American living their lives in thousands of places where indignity and injustice were the everyday realities, that then when they called for, asked for help in the midst of moments of great risk and boldness and vision, he couldn't say no. But it took a toll on him. I didn't know, maybe some of you do, that he would periodically have to check himself into the hospital with exhaustion and depression, having broken his body completely down. I did know that he had deep struggles with infidelity. Who knows, maybe also one way to channel the need for human solace, I don't know. All of it comes out so much more in the book. His long-term relationship with Dorothy Cotton, all the women that he knew, everyone who knew. This man who struggles so deeply with his own limits, physical, spiritual, evident in conversations with his friends and in the FBI records. This heroic humanity. And I could do actually a whole sermon on this, but I want to say something about this in this moment for all of us. I want to say what it brings up for us as Americans that I think is about a lot more than King. Our relationship with our heroes. I think we Americans, I don't know how much it's universally true across cultures, I think we love to put our heroes up on pedestals. And then we love, in a New York minute, to tear them down as fast as we have put them up. And I don't know, maybe it's our childhood psyche that needed a parent that we could trust to keep us safe in the world, and that's what rears up in our adult life and compels us to put or try to put people up on pedestals. And maybe it's our adult psyche that the moment we do so knows from experience that no person is without flaws and struggles with what to do with that, and that those two forces in us just do a tremendous amount of evil on so many levels, and we need to put them to rest. And the struggle and the conversations about Martin Luther King Jr., his heroism and his flawed humanity is a perfect example of where that's shown up in the national conversation through the decades. This need for perfect heroes and heroines deeply misguided. My Hebrew Scriptures professor at Harvard, who was an Orthodox practicing Jew, pointed out that in the Hebrew Scriptures, there's not a single hero or heroine who is not complicated or flawed. Even God goes off the rails and apologizes regularly. Remember the rainbow in the sky? It's the gift and the promise from God who has wiped almost everybody off the planet, that that was maybe an error, an extreme, and he will never do it again. And there is truth in those stories, deep truth in that way of telling the story about who we human beings are and who God is and obligations in this truth. The danger of the pedestal, the evil of it even, if we can use that language in Unitarian Universalist circles, is that it can look like we're being super humble and giving someone else their props by putting them up there, like, oh, let's just acknowledge how great this person is. But I challenge us that what it actually does in practice is gets us off the hook. And no one gets off the hook. And we of all people should know that. We, Unitarians, are the people of low Christology. Here's some theology. Anybody know what low Christology is? Oh, it sounds base, doesn't it? But it's actually beautiful. Low Christology, and we Unitarians are people who said that Jesus wasn't God different from us. Jesus was divine and human and meshed, but someone who fully realized his divinity as a human being. And the beauty of low Christology, like not putting heroes on pedestals, is that we are called to live into it. It's a brilliant, honest truth about human nature, and it is this moral call that calls us accountable to our own leadership responsibilities. To restate, you might say, King's major drum major sermon, you don't have to have a college degree to lead, and you don't have to have your verbs and your subjects agree to lead. You only need this heart full of grace and generated by love to be that leader. King was just one such person who realized his divinity in extraordinary ways, who felt so deeply the wrongness of the world and his obligation to be some part of fixing it, though his privileged status could have easily had him living out in some ivory tower as an academic, or he could have just stayed put and fought battles in his own small local city or town, like all of us. But he didn't. And he did have spiritual struggles, and he did have broken places, and they weren't hard to find, and he knew them most of all. I just think that's so important for us to realize. And also to realize that if we embraced this, this truth that we're all called to leadership, that the exhaustion that he and other leaders feel, the fear of stepping into leadership, might actually go away, because we'd create a world that welcomes one another into it and that no one is afraid that leadership will kill us. The more, the merrier. So reading it raised the question for me that I offered to you of, where do you lead? Where do you step in, knowing your gifts and your limits, and still fail forward, succeed forward? And where do you let yourself off the hook? And who do we expect will save us? So, the FBI and the vigilance of liberty as we step into this new era, the truth of heroic humanity and the call to leadership and to nurture it and expect it in ourselves and one another, and the beauty that unleashes and the possibilities, And the final theme for me that emerged in this book, that I, in this look behind the curtain of the civil rights movement, was a reminder of something that I know, but I need to be reminded of, that this was this patchwork, improvisational effort to organize toward change. And that the story of the civil rights movement, the day-to-day story of the civil rights movement, was two steps forward and some days one and three-quarters steps back. And inner debates and differences of opinion and all the challenges along the road, from, let's say, the Montgomery bus boycott to the Voting Rights Act, all of it, none of it a given. And part of the 700 pages of this book, if you choose to read it, is lots of detail about all these meetings and who was in them and what was decided or what was debated and who paid for what or whether they had the money to pay for the things they needed to, and the planning and the threats and the surprises and the heartbreaks and the miracles. Each small town struggle with a sheriff or a mob that brings out the activists and the determined, incessant drumbeat of what King would call the extremism of their demands for justice. And up against it always, just as activated, were the extremists for racism and status quo. It reminded me how you and I, our nation, our world, I don't know how we so often paint these stories of these times in retrospect as inevitable. The colonists inevitably were going to succeed in ousting the British rule, and the North would defeat the South, of course, and women would get the vote. There was no doubt about it, and Hitler would be defeated in history, and the real deal in the details is anything ever but inevitable. There are always these turning points and these moments where we don't know how things will break. And these times where everything hangs in the balance. And the moral arc of the universe that bends toward justice does so because in those moments, someone reaches up, or a whole host of people, and pulls the ark down to touch the earth against all the forces that would stop them. But there's so much greed or ego or human desire for power over and a thousand things working against that. Working against the kindness and trust and equity and risk and boldness and virtue on the other side. Nothing inevitable, ever. So maybe Martin Luther King's celebrated day overlapping with inauguration is a good thing. A reminder of what nation building requires, what moral leadership and beloved community has always required, that we stay watchful for power corrupting influences, and we demand guardrails against overreach and accountability from our government leaders, and we pay attention with eternal vigilance. That we are, all of us, called to lead with our messy, full humanity, warts and all, and that we're aware of the obligation to attend to each other and keep our leaders, all of us, whole in whatever the chapter requires of us. And that this next chapter will be a journey like any other that is never inevitable. But that these ideals, visions of a beautiful world, of what love looks like incarnate, that I think are sort of pressed into us before we enter the world, that we're called to make more manifest. Well, that we're stepping into our chapter of a legacy of people who got their hands dirty trying to translate what they knew to be beautiful, true, and good into what they saw and felt in their world and handed on. So, my good people, I am nervous. I am scared. I am hopeful. I want us to love each other deeply through the next 4 years and beyond and cultivate practices of self-care and mutual care and rest that feeds the courage we will need. I want us to continue practice showing up. I want us to look not for heroes or saviors, but companions. And I pray with every fiber of my being that the heroes and heroines of the past whisper encouragement and guidance into the winds that will blow in these stormy times. Jonathan Egg ended his biography of King with these words from one such hero. Our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, to remain vigilant, and face the challenge of change. May it be so. And may we make it so. Blessings on us all. Amen. Let's sing. Oh, I love the flag. I love the flag. I was saying today, I wished I had a red, white, and blue outfit. Patriotism, country is ours too, right? I love that. Thank you for bringing that flag.
Instead of a reflection, I'll be reading Extremists of Justice by Martin Luther King Jr. The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie nor establish truth. Through violence, you murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. The question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice?